This is A People's Climate, powered by Wild Seeds Fund, from Counterstream Media and The Nation. I'm your host, Shilpi Chotre.
Well, back in the 1980s, a part of South Louisiana gained a nickname that was as frightening as it was controversial. The seven parishes along the Mississippi River between New Orleans and Baton Rouge became known as Cancer Alley.
I don't think a lot of people know that, but when someone dies in prison, their dead body is still shackled until it gets to the morgue.
This is the violence of institutions.
All prisons are toxic, but there's some of them that are more toxic than others.
Our whole tribe and community is displaced, and it makes it hard to continue your culture from one generation to the next, whereas normally grandparents pass on their culture to their kids and then to their grandkids. We don't have that anymore because nobody's together anymore.
Welcome to the season finale of A People's Climate. Thank you so much for tuning in to our inaugural season. Today's episode was recorded live in New York City back in September during Climate Week. And for most people in the climate movement, Climate Week is known to be a blur of panels and pledges running from one event to the next with these polished talking points, you know, about carbon and net zero goals. But our event was all about centering stories from the front lines. I was honored to host this evening with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Margot Brown. She's the Senior Vice President of Justice and Equity at the Environmental Defense Fund. We brought together three incredible frontline media makers to share their stories. You'll hear from Chantal Cormerdell, a member of the Isle de Jean Charles Choctaw Nation, the first federally recognized community of climate refugees in the United States. Let's listen to a little of her film, Preserving Our Place.
Our community is on the southern coast of Louisiana, basically in the Gulf of Mexico. My kids will never see the things on the island that I saw. They'll never get to go fish in the front bayou for crabs because the front bayou is now cut off by a levee and there's no water passing through and it's just overgrown. And it's heartbreaking to see that. We have two generations now that have no idea of what it is to have life on the island and have that culture. I want to capture as many of those memories before they're gone.
There's also B. Preston Lyles, lead organizer for the Toxic Prisons Campaign, whose work exposes the intersection of mass incarceration and environmental harm, what he calls toxic prisons.
This was a spot where all the coal mines in the area used to dump their waste. And then when a new company took over, what they did was they started dumping coal ash on top of that waste.
When inmates would wash their clothes, it came back with this awful smell that was similar to that of urine. And they're expecting us to bathe in this water and drink it.
The dogs were being given bottled water and the guards were being given bottled water. But the men in prison were still drinking that polluted water. People were breaking out in rashes, coughs, and it was just horrible.
This is what's been going on all over the country, that you have contaminated land. After it's been depleted of all its resources and everything good, it's being sold to corrections in different states. We're seeing the same stories throughout the country.
And last but not least, Alexandra Norris. She's the filmmaker behind Let No One Lose Heart. Her documentary follows legendary Louisiana activist Miss Sharon Levine and her fight against big plastic in Cancer Alley.
Why are we letting this industry come in here? Our public officials, they're allowing it to come in here. And they said, oh, there's nothing you could do about it. It's a done deal. I spoke to God. I asked him what to do. And he said, fight.
All right, here's our conversation live from Climate Week.
Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
So I'd like to begin with introductions very briefly from all three of you. And as you are answering that part of the question, I also want you to reflect on this quote by Malcolm X in 1963 in his message to the grassroots. And that was, all revolution begins on land.
Hi, I'm Chantel Carmadale. I'm from Houma, Louisiana, originally from the Isle of Jean Charles. Yeah, boots on the ground. That's where we start.
I'm Alex Norris. I am a filmmaker. I think that revolution starts to happen and bubble up when people are too tightly squeezed and the land is squeezed and extraction is happening and happening and happening until the people can't take it anymore. I am not quite sure that there is yet a revolution happening in Cancer Alley, but I am sure that we need one.
I am B. Preston Lyles. When I think about the quote, just in case you don't know this, I happen to be a black man. And having been a black man for nearly 50 years, I'm abundantly clear of the severity of injustice. I'm abundantly clear about the assumptions of our ignorance. I'm abundantly clear about the devaluing of our lives. I am abundantly clear about the overlooking of our humanity, about the reduction of our dignity, about the theft of our culture, about the usurping of our names. I'm abundantly clear about the injustice of the carceral system in the United States of America, which was the export of enslavement. And I'm abundantly clear that American prison is the trash can of this country. If a revolution is to begin, it must begin on the ground, because while ideals may be lofty, movement happens in low places.
I want to ask a question to you, Chantel, just to kick us off here on this theme of land and displacement. Your story is particularly urgent. When we think about climate migration, we're thinking about Tuvalu, we're thinking about Pakistan. We're not thinking about our own country here in Louisiana. What BP was talking about this history that we have to come to terms with as an environmental movement. We can't glaze over genocide, of slavery, of land theft. How does that show up in your work, especially in documenting? And I know we've had conversations about how important this is as a mother of three.
So we ended up in the land that we're at right now because of that genocide, that Indian Removal Act. Basically, the United States kicked all the Native Americans out of the country because that was not the United States yet. So this has been going on for generations, and it's going to take more than just a little bit to stop. Even as much as last week, we are still fighting a fight against politicians and the state, the beautiful community center that's supposed to be for the tribe to use and have functions. And as of last week, the state turned it over to another nonprofit in our city. So we have nothing to do with any of that land, any of that we helped write everything to get the grant to try to move our people to safety and try to have a place that our people can call their own. So it's continued disheartening over and over and over. So not only did they lose the land, we're losing parts of culture. We're losing even the ability to convene and have a place to come together. I was displaced off the island when I was three. I developed asthma from the mold, from the repeat floodings. So we had to either move I developed asthma and I would be put in a hospital every few months. So my dad made that hard decision to move, and now the whole tribe has had to make that hard decision to move.
Thank you for sharing. I want to be really clear that Louisiana is a petrostate. It's heavy fossil fuel production. Every single sort of refinery is there. It's where plastic comes from. And that lands me to Ms. Sharon Levine's story and Alex's work with her very powerful film. Ms. Sharon is leading with incredible courage, and at the heart of her activism is her spirituality. And when I came into the work, I had never experienced this side of the environmental work before, what faith means to so many advocates, especially in the Gulf South. And Alex, I want to know for you as a filmmaker, you know, how has that journey in being behind the lens and capturing Ms. Sharon and her story influenced you and how you show up in your work?
I came to this story probably really arrogant. I have been a filmmaker for 15 years, and I was raised in the Black church, good Sunday school going, been confirmed, was married in the church girl, but I have really struggled with my faith through my adolescence and as an adult, and really on my best days was sort of agnostic about my beliefs. And when I came to this story, I said to myself, I never said to Sharon, thank God, but I said to myself that this was not going to be a religious film. And as soon as I met Sharon, it became really clear to me that to do that would be a lie, because that is who Sharon is. She has restored my faith. So we are coming up on 5 years, and it has been a journey, a really difficult journey that most days did not feel smart to pursue. Many days wanted to just say, hey, this is not going to work. It's time to throw in the towel. But making the story, this is the part where I cry, about Sharon and watching her walk in her faith, never giving up against odds that compared to mine were really, really insurmountable. It was like, how can I turn away from this if she's not turning away from her work? The other thing about Sharon's faith that's been really amazing to watch is that, like, we think a lot in the secular world, and that thinking stymies the work. And Sharon just does, because she doesn't have to think about the why, the ifs, the should she, is there approval? She already has her approval. And so she is just able to, like, plow through and do. And that is one of the things that I think makes her so effective, that she's not stopping to contemplate a whole lot, because she's already been given her answer. And that is amazing to watch, the power of that cut through the fat in this work and in the movement. Nice.
BP, I would be amiss if we didn't talk about the role of faith in all you do. Take it away.
So let me make an unashamed announcement. I am bold-faced, unbiased, unashamed. I am a Christian. What I know that is born out of the scripture is that the revolutionary love of God means that we stand with each other in the arm of love, that we wish to restore the dignity of all humanity, that we wish to see people live well. We wish to see people achieve their dreams. We wish to see people stand when the world has torn them down. Those who have been incarcerated, those who are incarcerated now, I mentioned that America has a trash can. And it's been marketed for generations, that anybody who has been in prison deserves it, and that they don't deserve to live after it. It has been severely, tragically overlooked, the level of injustice, the level of lies, the level of deception, the fact that human life is often bought and sold in courtrooms, the fact that human lives are often bought and sold over coffee. Many people who are incarcerated, especially in Pennsylvania, all over the country, but in Pennsylvania, there are nearly 40,000 men and women behind walls. That's currently. It is costing Pennsylvania taxpayers over $3 billion, with a B, billion dollars a year to finance incarceration. And that is just the prisons, their staff, and the land. That is not the court system and the lawyers and the county jails. Faith means that I move forward, not failing or giving up. It means that I do not tell anybody that they are not worth the life that God gave them. Faith means that I fight and that I stand on behalf of my brothers and my sisters, because that's what Jesus did for me. I do not throw people away. In fact, I go get them.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, get up to 80% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, seasonal decor, and way more. All at Wayfair. These are Wayfair's best deals of the year. From seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, enjoy fast and free shipping with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 80% off during Wayfair's Black Friday sale. Now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
When the three of you were speaking, I kept thinking about extractive narratives, which is so harmful for anyone that reads media, that absorbs media. It's how we shape policy. It's how we shape culture. Narrative is, it's everything. It's at the fundamental core of how we're going to move the needle on issues. So when we talk about the carceral system, when we talk about Cancer Alley, when we talk about Indigenous sovereignty, right now the narrative is painted in a very extreme right-wing light. And what Margot and I were excited about with the three of you in particular is you are actively shifting that narrative. And it's a difficult thing to do. So I want to ask you, as media makers, we are up against a lot when it comes to winning that narrative. And how are you coping with that pressure right now?
Yeah, so I think that extraction is coming from both sides as it relates to climate issues and environmental justice issues. I work in climate politics, and I came to this story in 2020 when environmental justice was like the hot ticket. My family is from the Gulf South on my father's side, and I opened a ProPublica article and read about Sharon for the first time. I'd never heard of Cancer Alley, and like my brain just broke. I had spent so much time in New Orleans and never heard of this thing, and Sharon really resonated with me just as a person. She felt familiar, but all that I saw of her in the media was really two-dimensional. She was clearly like had been picked at that time as the poster woman for the movement. And when I started to like get to know her and we're shooting with her, like she would come to New York or she would come to DC, but not have a ride from the airport. I work in climate politics and I see the resources that are sloshing around, organizations lighting money on fire for tactics that are not effective, that do not break through. But this 70-year-old grandmother is landing in a place foreign from her home with no per diem and no car service. And my husband would like pick her up from the train station sometimes. Like, it just broke my brain. And so my intention from the very beginning of this story was to show not only Sharon, but the folks in her orbit, Shamira, her family, the rest of the community in full dimension. These are not two-dimensional people. They are three-dimensional, multidimensional human beings with wins and also with losses, with deep, deep losses that are a result of the work that they are putting themselves out to do. There is cost to this work on their personal lives and well-being, and that is overlooked. It's just like victory, victory, rah, 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 until whatever group is done and moved on to the next. And that is what I've seen, is like the cycle has turned and environmental justice is now on the back burner and it's not a thing that the green groups are interested in. And so it's just not on the table anymore. And again, the real thing that I hope comes through in this film is that these people are sacrificing themselves to advance these issues. And then we come to Climate Week and have wine and cheese and shake their hands and go home, but they are going home to continue the work. And I just don't want that to be overlooked or forgotten or minimized.
So well said, so well said. Chantal, can we go to you?
Yeah, I totally agree. Because I live it, like Ms. Sharon and them, I live it. And I think we need to collectively look beyond just St. James, because you can't go anywheres around South Louisiana from all the multiple petrochemical companies and trash without seeing somebody with cancer. I lost both my mom and my grandmother to cancer. So I think we all have that shared South Louisiana water and trash. And it's easy for a news report to come down and say, hey, we saw you. We want to see how the resettlement's going. Do you really want to see? They're already having major issues with homes. They had one minor little hurricane come through and siding was pulled off. Air conditioners on brand new homes are not working. Do you really want to see that? Or do you want to just post, oh, look, the pretty pictures of the houses are built and that's it. We helped another one and we're going. You know, do you want to stay and fight? I encourage you to dig deeper on what's not being in the mainstream media.
That's right. And I think what's so powerful about your story is that you are the documenter. That is massive. BP.
When it comes to struggle, struggle has to happen in the hands of those dealing with it. We don't have the privilege to stand off and behave and act as if we are aloof and untouched. I introduced myself by telling you, in case you didn't know, I'm a black man. They intend to start me from the back. People intend to see me as less than human. If this work is going to happen, then the narrative has to change. People have to see people as just that. We cannot see people as other. This is why abuses occur, because humans decide that other humans are somehow objects. I have to be a reductionist in order to stand by and watch your life fall apart and do nothing while my life is going just fine. That was probably more than your question.
I want you to just keep going. Just keep it on repeat. No, it is extremely powerful. And I'm so sad we only have a few minutes left. But I want to ask this question to you. In your own work, how do you resist the pressure to assimilate into broken systems?
I hear the words of the apostle say that you will know them that labor among you by the fruit that they bear. And though I'm not a farmer, my second, Sonny, is here. They are a farmer. And so tell me if I'm right about this. If one is to bear fruit, then that fruit needs to reflect the tree that it comes from. And if somehow the tree or the vine or the plant is producing fruit not of itself, then something is wrong. And it should be cut off. This work, these words of not being integrated into these false ideas, means that I always care, which means that fundamentally I will always fight for others, which means that at my core, I seek to see the humanity in those around me, and we just can't give up. And if you start from the back, there's a moment where there has to be an acceleration to catch up. I hope you heard me.
I had the great privilege and honor of being mentored by Haile Gerima, who is a lion of independent Black film. If you have not seen Sankofa, go find it somewhere and watch it. And he would always point in my face and say, you tell your own stories. We are 5 years in. We are free. We have no masters. We have not taken any money from any kind of equity source that would have like controls or strings on our story. And so we're able to say what we want. And I don't know, I was talking to a girl today at the Climate Film Festival, a young Howard University law student, and she was like, you're making a 90-minute film? Why? She was like, I try to pay attention to feature films, but I can't anymore. And I was like, are we done with this? Like, you have to push back and resist and keep on making this kind of media because the algorithm is broken already, right? And it's going to be up to like the repairers to fix it and to push it to its next place, to return to a place where social justice stories can be told and consumed and desired. And so that's kind of just what I'm going to keep on doing, I hope.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of the same. I'm a certified minister. And at the end of the day, I still have to answer to Jesus about what I do. And I have to look into my kids' face and all of our tribal members and say, I did what I could do to the end. I did everything I can do. And I told the state planners and all of this when they were working, I said, at the moment that I cannot fully feel like you are doing something right, I will leave. I said, I will not help you hurt my people. I can't look Rosie, she's one of our tribal elders, in the face and say, I'm sorry, I didn't do enough to try to save your home. I mean, they're fighting to try to keep what they have now, what they lost on the island. And I can't look in their face and say, I did everything I could do if I didn't. So at the end of the day, that's why I fight. That's why I go back and tell their stories. That's why I think we're all here listening, is because we want to make sure that those stories are true and that those are the stories that we tell. And we make sure that the true stories and the true history is written and acknowledged and pushed out.
Thanks all for your truth. And I want to leave folks with this. So less than 2% of climate philanthropy dollars are going to environmental justice and just transition issues. There are some key people in the room. I need you to hear this. $60 million went to fall solutions, tech solutions, carbon capture, etc. This is the week where we need you all to carry this message forward. It's literally life or death for many of these communities. So, you know, it's an honor to be in this space with you, but that comes with a responsibility as well. I'm going to invite our dear colleague Margot Brown to say a few words.
I want to share a quote with all of you by Maya Angelou. And it says, I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. Thank you for making us feel your plight this evening.
Most climate stories pass through institutions with little to no connection to the communities that are most affected, reducing complex realities to mere headlines and distancing us from those on the front lines. And it's no surprise that so many of us end up feeling exhausted or hopeless. That's exactly how the systems maintaining the status quo want us to feel. But the people you just heard, and all of my guests throughout the season, cut through that noise. And despite the political and personal risks, they continue to organize and make their power known. Their clarity is a reminder of what this moment demands from all of us, to pay attention, stay accountable, and to align our actions with the people most impacted.
None of this happens alone. It requires courage, hard decisions, and a willingness to stay engaged, especially when it's uncomfortable. So I'll leave you with this. Where can you align your resources, your energy, your voice? If these stories moved you, help us keep a people's climate alive. Donate today at counterstream.org and stay connected. Sign up for our newsletter for more stories on climate and environmental justice. A huge shout out to the Environmental Defense Fund and the Frontline Resources Institute for sponsoring this timely conversation. Thank you to Wild Seeds Fund for making this podcast possible. This episode of A People's Climate is executive produced by Mindy Raymaker, with engineering and sound design by Dennis Maxwell. Theme music by Caffrey J, recorded at Studio 132 in Oakland, California. From Counterstream Media and The Nation, I'm your host, Shilpi Chotre. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back soon.